Hello and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And I am here in Sandston, Virginia today. We're actually in the Sandston Baptist Church, which is near the airport. And you may hear an airplane fly over in the background. But we just finished up a pastor's fraternal meeting, actually in a local restaurant. And the Sandston Baptist Church is just right down the road, and they agreed to let us have a Sunday school room, and so we're sitting here. And I'm joined by four other brothers from Virginia, and we're going to have a little bit of a pastor's roundtable, and we're going to discuss, in part, a book that is titled On Being Reformed, subtitled Debates Over a Theological Identity. Some of the guys have read the book, others have not read it completely, but more generally we're going to be addressing an issue that is part of this book, and that is it proper and appropriate to refer to Reformed Baptists as being Reformed? Is that a proper term? Is it inappropriate? Should we not use that term because that should be only exclusively used by those who are Presbyterians or practice paedobaptism or who are part of maybe the traditional Reformed denominations. So that's really the subject we're going to be talking about. And so let me just introduce the guys who are here. I'll let them introduce themselves. If we just go around, everybody tell your name and maybe what church you're from. So Ryan, start us off.
Sure. Ryan Davidson from Grace Baptist Chapel in Hampton, Virginia.
Van Loomis from Redeeming Grace Baptist Church in Gloucester, Virginia.
Marvin Jones from Redeeming Grace Baptist Church in Gloucester, Virginia.
Steve Clevenger from Covenant Reformed Baptist Church in Warrenton, Virginia.
Great. Thank you, guys. And we just had a get-together, ate some good barbecue, and had a chance to share things that were happening in our ministry, and these guys agreed then to help me with this podcast. It's going to just kind of be a pastor's roundtable. So let me just give a little bit of an overview of this book, and then we'll get into some discussion. So this book, again, was published in 2018. It's published by a small academic press that is called, what is it, Palgrave Pivot. I think it's a subdivision of Macmillan, but this book is expensive, and they're going just for the academic market. Don't you hate that when the books are expensive?
Yeah.
So so this book costs like $69, and I got an e version of it to review, and it came out in 2018. But this book was really a response to a much earlier book. And I think the guys around the table here have read probably that book. And that book is by R. Scott Clark, who teaches at Westminster Seminary West. And that book came out in 2008 from Presbyterian Reformed. It was an influential book, was much read, you know, more than 10 years ago. It's hard to believe that now. But it was titled Recovering the Reformed Confession. And in that book, R. Scott Clark was trying to basically speak to his fellow Reformed paedobaptists and say that they needed to tighten up the boundaries. I think a lot of that may have been in response to Young Wrestleson Reform, New Calvinists, and he's tightening up and saying, no, you're not really Reformed just because you say you believe in the sovereignty of God and salvation. And he was kind of a back to confessional Christianity, Reformed confessional Christianity. And along the way in that, he was saying, you know, you can't really be a Reformed Baptist. That is an oxymoron. You can't be a Reformed and a Baptist. And so this little booklet comes along, and it is brief. It's it only consists of four chapters. It's only I think 94 pages, And so there are four essays in this booklet. And the first essay is by two guys. I'm not sure how you pronounce this first guy's name. Chris Coughey? C-A-U-G-H-E-Y. You think that's the way you pronounce it? And he co-authored that with Crawford Gribben. And they wrote an essay called History, Identity, Politics, and the Recovery of the Reformed Confession. And then there's a second essay by Matthew C. Bingham, which is titled Reformed Baptist, Anachronistic, Oxymoron, or Useful Signpost. And so the first two essays are coming from a Baptist perspective. And both of the essays are very ably written by these guys who are saying, hey, you know, Baptists should not be excluded, that they should be considered. It's appropriate for them to be called Reformed. And then there are two essays sort of representing the counterpoint to that. The first one is by Daryl Hart, D.G. Hart, and it's titled Baptists Are Different. And then the last one is by R. Scott Clark himself, and it's titled A House of Cards, A Response to Bingham, Gribben, and again, I think it's Coughey. I'm not sure if that's his name. If he ever listens to this or someone knows, feel free to correct me. So, again, we could go in a lot of different directions with this. Maybe I could just give a quick summary of the first chapter, and then we can talk a little bit about it. So the first chapter by Coughey and Gribben, basically they say that if you look at church history and you look at the history of the Reformation, there never was, they say, a single Reformed confession. There are many Reformed confessions, and there's not one authoritative Reformed confession. So there are many trajectories. And they make the point that even with the Westminster Confession of Faith, that they say there were four principal editions of that. There was the one in put together at Westminster, then there was a Scottish revision, then there's been American revision. And so they say there is no single confession to recover. And so they make a lot in that first chapter about the fact that the view of contemporary Presbyterians, particularly those like R. Scott Clark and Daryl Hart, who've embraced the so-called Two Kingdoms theology, that's a departure from the Westminster view of the relationship between the church and the state, for example. And he actually says, kind of interestingly, he says the truly Reformed of today actually hold views with regard to their understanding of church and state that are closer to the 1689 Second London Baptist Confession. There goes the plane overhead. He says this raises problems of inconsistencies for those he calls the Reformed policemen who are trying to keep everybody in order. Don't use the name Reformed unless you practice infant baptism. And they basically call for more modesty and charity from others. And at one point they say, well, both parties could come from the same tree, but they could each receive the legacy of Reformed confessions in a different way. And anyways, one of the striking things about that opening chapter is he says, or they say on page 24, we're all Anabaptists now. That is, we've all adopted a different position than, say, the Westminster Confession of Faith had with regard to the state enforcing religious beliefs in the modern age. So let me just pause here. I've talked a lot. And what do you guys think? I mean, what have you heard about this whole discussion? And is it appropriate for Reformed Baptists to call themselves Reformed? What do you think?
Well, I think, just in what you just said, I like what is written here in the book, because even the OPC codifies on their website what you just stated about the different confessions. And I'll just read this straight out of the book. It says, quote, "Perhaps the most honestly of all, the website of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church guides readers through the history of emendations and indicates how its own confessional position relates to these earlier recensions, admitting its adoption of only, quote, some of the revisions made by the American Presbyterian Church in 1903. For all its candor, this denominational website effectively publicizes the problem. There are now so many ways for contemporary Presbyterian churches to receive the Westminster Confession of Faith that we cannot be sure what a so-called confessional commitment actually amounts to, except that the confessing church is almost certainly not receiving the text that was produced by the Westminster Assembly of Divines in April 1647 and used by the English National Church, nor that adopted with qualifications by the Church of Scotland later that same summer. We do not believe, as Scott Clark has argued, that, quote, it is the nominalistic spirit of our age that suggests that it is misleading to speak of the Reformed Confession or the Reformed Theology, Piety, and Practice. Instead, as a survey of the evolution of the Westminster Confession indicates, there are many competing Reformed confessions and many competing editions of one of their most influential representatives. Even within the transatlantic Presbyterian tradition, there is no single confession to recover, and the problem is magnified when other traditions with roots in the Calvinistic Reformation are also considered. The confessions provide a very limited theological foundation for contemporary discussions that search for a stable definition of quote-unquote reformed," end quote. So again, just what you're saying, you know, if we're trying to come back to one solid standard reformed confession that we can go back to historically, find the origin, bring it back forward, and then take all these churches and put it under that umbrella, there is no such a confession as that.
Mm-hmm. And so what would you say, though, when they say, well, but the 1689 confession is outside the boundaries because it teaches a practice of baptism that is completely alien to that which is taught in other, in even all the revisions of the Westminster Confession of Faith. They don't alter the teaching on baptism.
Well, again, that is the question. Where do you bring up, you know, you say all the revisions, where do you bring up and draw the line in that we'll take all these changes, but no more?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, that's argued in the book. You know, again, we are looking at a different covenant theology, which undergirds a different view of baptism. But again, this is all coming out of the same Reformed family tree that all these other confessions are coming out of. And look at what they've changed. They've made their changes as well. And so there is not one conformed confessional document that we're all subscribing to. And they even point out even some small contradictions within the three forms of unity themselves.
Mm-hmm. What about just on a practical level as pastors? Obviously, first of all, one question would be, do you put Reformed Baptist in the name of your church? And I'm sitting around here around the table, I think some of us have done that and others of us have not. But if you advertise that you're a Reformed Baptist church, they're relatively few. I mean, we think about it in Virginia, there are probably, you know, less than 15 churches that will self-identify as being Reformed Baptist. Have you had an experience of having people come to you and ask you, what does it mean to be Reformed? What is a Reformed Baptist? I know Reformed Presbyterians, but what's a Reformed Baptist? Or maybe more likely, have you had people just say, what does that mean exactly? Are you trying to reform Jesus? You know, are you trying to reform the Bible? I mean, what's been your experience?
And I'll just jump in just because of your last comment here. We don't put Reformed Baptist in our name simply because of that, and it comes from personal experience. Many years ago, in the 1990s, I was in the Navy station on Guam, and my wife and I were looking for a church. So we're just driving through the different, well, there's not many streets on Guam, but the few there were, and we came by a church that was called Reformed Presbyterian Church. And our conversation immediately went to, I wonder what they had to change, what they had to reform. Is this a church split? Was there? So instantly it was all surrounded around negativity. And again, granted, it's because we didn't know the loaded term of what reformed or reformation means. But for someone like that, again, it instantly went to, this just sounds like bad news here with this church. They've had to change from something, and change, you know, at that early stage of my doctrinal development, usually equaled liberalism. And so for that reason, we don't advertise our church up front or have, you know, Reformed Baptist in our church, but like on our website and places like that, I mean, it's not something we hide either. We come full out, you know, with it. But as far as like that initial, you know, like in the name of the church sign, you know, in our day and time, we're just thinking that probably not a lot of people know what that means, and they would have more of sort of a negative connotation of that. They've reformed from something else.
So, Steve, I know you've got Reformed in your name, but what's the counterpoint to that? Why? What's the argument in favor of calling yourself Covenant Reformed Baptist Church?
Yeah, we wanted to, in the setting of, I mean, we are in Virginia. This is below the Mason-Dixon line, so there's a plethora of Baptist churches everywhere. And so we wanted to, as we might say, we wanted there to be truth in advertising, that we are a Reformed Baptist Church, which that has become the language to define a church that subscribes to the Second London Baptist of 1689. And so we wanted that to be made known, to be clear. If people were looking for a Reformed Baptist church, we wanted them to easily to be able to find us. And we have had that to be the case. And we have had folks come up to us and ask, so what is a Reformed Baptist? Did your church dissolve and now it's returned together and it's reforming?
Reformed.
Yes. And then that gives us the opportunity to talk to them about the Reformed faith and what it means and what's contained in our confession of faith. So
I'm just curious as a tangent. Let's say you run into somebody. This happens to all of us. Somebody who maybe comes and they absolutely have no idea at all. How do you begin to explain what Reformed theology is to that person?
Well, with us, and this has actually happened. This has happened in the church foyer. We have a banner hanging with the five solas. And I usually just begin by pointing to the banner and start walking through, you know, Scripture alone, what that means. Christ alone, grace alone, faith alone, sola Deo gloria, and beginning from there. And the truth is, most conservative, Bible-believing evangelicals are basically on board with that. Now, they may not understand all the nuances of that, but they're on board with that. If you can begin there, and they say, okay, so you have a serious view of the Scriptures, a high view of the Bible, usually with that connection, you can begin to move out from there and begin to talk to them more about what it means to be Reformed.
I'm just glad you've got that visual aid.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, if you don't have that visual aid, yeah, how could you possibly explain?
My question is, is it in Latin or English?
No. We have it in Latin and then English underneath.
You got the translation.
Yeah, we have it in both there.
No, I think in terms of Reformed Baptists, I think that's a good way to do it. And I think a lot of Reformed Baptists mean that. They're not trying to trace their heritage back to the Westminster or even the 1689, the reaction of that and modification of that in order to form a confession of faith. I think they basically nailed their colors to the formal and material principles of the Reformation, the authority of Scripture and the justification by faith. And it's a shorthand way of saying that.
Yes.
As you say, it's just a way basically to start a conversation. And if we will do that, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Not to skip over to the end of the book, but again, that is one of the strongest points of disagreement that I just had to get up and walk away from the chapter occasionally in the last two chapters with Clark and Hart, is that very thing in which there's such a, I want to charitably call it ignorance on their part, because ignorance can be corrected, but of One, for one thing, trotting John Piper out almost in every example as a Reformed Baptist. John Piper's never identified himself as a Reformed Baptist, nor would he want to.
That's right.
And I think there is something about the 1689 Confession that leads us, whenever we do that, to go that far back, is to lead us into those areas to where we want to be involved with the broader stream of Reformed theology, understanding that we're never going to be in agreement with them on their view of the covenant that issues in baptism. That's ever going to be a point of conflict between us. But as the first chapter says, I mean, it is a small thing to admit in the light of the powerful function of a confession, in the sense that it nails your colors to the mast and you know what you have in common in addition to your distinctions. And it's a helpful way for us, and we found this as well, not only for Baptists that are coming through the area, but we've also in the history of our church had Presbyterians, we've had other Reformed churches come through, although it's not in our name, being known as a Reformed Baptist Church and being associated with Reformed Baptist websites and having references from those, it is enough. And at that point then, they have a certain set of expectations coming into us, and it is a point of fellowship. It is a point where almost immediately we can again bonding and identifying, and it is a shorthand for us. We all have had that point to where when you go to a church, I mean, there are a lot of groundwork you have to get through. It cuts through a lot of that and really, I think, forms a more solid form of fellowship and of union than anything else would be, I think.
Mm-hmm. Ron, what's been your experience?
So I've pastored our church now for about 11 years, and we adopted the confession in an unamended way, unredacted way, a few years back. And we have not changed our name or added the word Reformed in front of Baptist just because of the practicalities of having to change all your documents and all of that. But what we have done is in our email signatures and even on our sign, we put Reformed under the name because we do, kind of like what you said, Steve, we kind of want people to recognize that there are some distinctions about us. Now, for us, we internally have often used the phrase confessionally Reformed because, and maybe this is some of the reaction of R. Scott Clark and others, Reformed Baptist has come to mean a whole host of things. You know, you have people like John Piper and John MacArthur being called Reformed Baptist, whether they would call themselves that or not. And what that typically means is a Baptist who's a Calvinist in one way or another. And we use that phrase confessionally Reformed, not because we want to be snobby, but because in a lot of ways, Baptists in America have been, if I could use the word, unaware or even ignorant of our own history. And so when you teach people a lot about who the particular Baptists were, and then how they made their way to this country, and how a lot of Southern Baptists, pretty much, if memory serves, the whole host of Southern Baptists in the early, 1850s, the beginning of that denomination, were adherents to our confession, then you begin to see, wait a minute, we're not the oddballs, but we're actually in some sense using that word to say this is where we've come from, and it's a good thing. So we use the word Reformed. I think it's helpful. People who look for us are looking for us because of that, and then others who are blissfully unaware come into some great theological truths.
What do you do, though? Well, the same question I asked Steve. When you get someone, let's say, who is a Christian or maybe not a Christian, you're evangelizing, and they ask you, what is Reformed theology? How would you respond to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple of ways you could do that or that I would do that based on the context but of the conversation. But I think starting with what the Reformation was, and then the next piece is the importance of understanding what the Bible had to say about a whole host of theological doctrines, and how during this Reformation there was the need to have doctrinal and confessional expression of what the Bible was saying in a whole host of areas, and how, and I think I'm borrowing here from our brother Jim Renahan, how these systems of doctrine are threads which run into one another. And so these confessions then begin to be a teaching tool. of what we actually believe the Word to say. And that's kind of the approach that I would take. If you pull one thread, as I've heard Jim say, you're going to be tugging on other areas because they're interrelated. And so that's kind of how I would take it. As a new believer, I might start somewhere differently, just kind of depending on their situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like what Steve said. I mean, maybe I think somebody who is either a new believer or somebody you're evangelizing, maybe starting with, we have a high view of the Scriptures.
Yeah.
We want to order our doctrine and our practice according to Scripture. So sola scriptura. We start with the authority of the Bible, and I think even an immature Christian can sort of intuitively, be drawn to that. So let me move on and talk a little bit about the second article, and this one is by Matthew C. Bingham, and he teaches at. I should have said, by the way, that Crawford Gribben is at Queen's University Belfast, and Chris Coffey, again, I'm still not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is apparently also there. The second article, again, from Matthew Bingham, who's at Oak Hill College, teaches systematic theology and church history there. And this is a really good article. It's titled, Reformed Baptists, Anachronistic Oxymoron or Useful Signpost. And he starts off by saying that this issue is more complicated than it might at first appear. And he uses this metaphor throughout. You know, is calling somebody a Reformed Baptist, is that anachronistic? Is it oxymoronic? You can't be Reformed and believe in credo baptism. Or is it a useful signpost? And he starts off, maybe what you were saying, we'll maybe get to this a little bit later, by saying, okay, we all agree that being Reformed is not a matter simply of holding to divine sovereignty. It's not a matter simply of holding to a monergistic view of soteriology. But it's something more. But then his question is the 1689 confession an early modern Reformed confession? So should the 1689 confession, should it be considered a Reformed confession? Of course, in the last chapter, Scott Clark is going to put the dividing line is the Westminster Confession. That's the last Reformed confession. There aren't any written after that. Of course, that conveniently cuts off not only the 1689 Baptist Confession, but also the Savoy Declaration. So he apparently doesn't see John Owen as being Reformed either. But anyways, he goes on to say in the end that he believes that calling the early particular Baptist, Reformed Baptist, would be anachronistic. So he says, historically, it's probably not good for us to refer to Benjamin Keach as a Reformed Baptist. That's an anachronism. They did not use that term. But, he would say, it's not oxymoronic. And they thought of themselves as being part of the Reformation spirit. And so it's a useful signpost. Just as a little side note, within the chapters I'm giving an overview, he has an interesting discussion of how the term Reformed Baptist first began to be used. And the story I had always heard, I'll hear from you guys, I had heard that Walt Chantry had coined the term when he was a student at Westminster Seminary. But on page 33, he says that the term was first used at Westminster Chapel in London, that there were a group of Baptistic students who would come and listen to D. Martin Lloyd-Jones in his Friday lectures when he went through Romans, and they were Baptistic, but they were drawn to Reformed theology, and he says that's the origin of it, which I'd never heard before, so it's an interesting historical question. And there was a. I'm gonna read a couple of quotes from Bingham because he has had some gems in here, but on page 34, there's a footnote where he has a quotation from a fellow named Edward Terrell, who was talking about Reformation that was going on at the Broadmead Particular Baptist Church in Bristol. And he says here, Terrell characterizes the rejection of paedobaptism as one part of a larger Reformation process through which he and his co-religionists cast off, quote, popish darkness, end quote, and, quote, were truly reformed in a great measure in turning from the worship of Antichrist, end quote. And he adds, here reformed clearly conveys a dynamic rather than a static sense, with the emphasis on movement away from Roman Catholicism. And so that's an interesting quotation, because there's a place where, you know, an early particular Baptist could see their movement as sort of a continuation of the Reformation spirit. Mm-hmm. And we've all heard some of our fellow Reformed Baptist pastors and theologians say similar types of things, that, you know, maybe it's our hubris sometimes to say, well, the Second London Confession, that's the apex of the Reformed Confessions. It went a little bit further. So there's also an interesting section in here where he talks about the time machine test. He says if we were to put it works two ways. He said if we were to put a modern Reformed Baptist in a time machine and send them back to the 17th century, the Presbyterian Westminster divines would understand that these men are not Anabaptists. They're not continental Anabaptists, you know, like the Mennonites or the Amish or whatever. Clearly, they're not that. By the same token, he says, if we were to take a typical modern Presbyterian and put them in the time machine and send them back, the Westminster divines might take a look at them and determine you're not really Reformed, because, you know, you hold an Anabaptistic view of the role of the state or in some other area. Let me just read briefly part of what he says. He says, this is page 40. To borrow Clark's own standard, if our time-traveling contingent of PCA ministers could not find hospitality at Dort or Westminster, might we not fairly ask whether the adjective reformed is properly used of them? The point is not to criticize these imaginary modern ministers, but simply to suggest that if the legitimate heirs of the reformed tradition are only those to whom early modern European Protestants would have offered a warm and full-throated welcome, then we will find the truly reformed to be a very small group indeed. So it's an interesting point I hadn't thought of before. In the end, he says Bingham says there are two main issues that separate Reformed Baptists from Reformed Presbyterians. And the first issue is ecclesiology, that it's typically perceived that Reformed Baptists had a more congregational view. But he says, if you go back and look at the early particular Baptists, he says their congregational ecclesiology was actually perhaps closer to Presbyterianism than many modern observers might realize. That's what he says on page 41. Then, with regard to baptism, he says clearly paedobaptism is a position which is often assumed to comprise the integrity of the Reformed Church. But he makes some interesting points here. He says, well, you know, Presbyterians share infant baptism with Roman Catholics, with Eastern Orthodox, with Lutherans. So it can't be the definitive issue that defines what it means to be Reformed. And he also says, interestingly enough, I think it was here, on page 46, he says Karl Barth, apparently in his writings, rejected infant baptism. Does that mean Karl Barth was not Reformed? And some conservative Reformed people say, yes, you're right. No, he's not Reformed.
But for a different reason.
Right. But, you know, typically he's thought of as a Reformed theologian, but in his writings, apparently, you got something banged
up. Well, he's got a quote from Scott Clark that describes Barth as, quote, the most influential Reformed theologian of the 20th century, end quote.
Yeah.
So Scott Clark is saying he's not just Reformed, but the most influential Reformed theologian of the 20th century.
Right. So this is some good polemical points for you to store up for your conversations with your paedobaptist friends. One last thing, and then we'll have a little more discussion. I think that even though this book is $69, Pages 47 and 48 almost make it worth the price. And I wanted to take an excerpt of this, actually do a blog post on it, and I still may. But Bingham nails it, I think, on these pages, from my perspective. And let me just read briefly his if you could bear with me, a little bit of these few excerpts here, starting on page 47. He says, the burden of this chapter has been to consider the appropriateness of the term Reformed Baptist, and in light of the preceding reflections, I would conclude that despite being often misused, surely overused, and admittedly anachronistic, the label Reformed Baptist remains a useful signpost for the 21st century church. Rather than obscuring the contemporary theological landscape, the term helpfully identifies a small subset of 21st century Christianity more accurately and more helpfully than do competing terms like Calvinistic Baptist or Sovereign Grace Baptist. And then he says, this is the summary I love. He says, within the wider Reformed tradition, Reformed Baptists affirm a monergistic soteriology, an appreciation of God's meticulous providence, and a robust declaration that all things work to the praise of the glory of His wisdom, power, justice, infinite goodness, and mercy. But alongside these things, and also in keeping with the wider Reformed tradition, Reformed Baptists affirm the regulative principle of worship, demand that a plurality of elders rule in the local congregation, and recognize the need that local churches not be isolated from one another, but are instead called to hold communion together for their mutual peace, union, and edification. With the wider Reformed tradition, Reformed Baptists embrace the Lord's Day as the Christian Sabbath, understand the Lord's Supper to be more than a bare memorial, but rather a means of grace given for our spiritual nourishment, and recognize that the Lord of the Decalogue has given, therefore, a summary statement of His immutable moral law. And with the wider Reformed tradition, Reformed Baptists understand all of Scripture is covenantally structured, rejecting dispensationalism, and seeing the New Testament church as properly and fully the Israel of God, Galatians 6:16. I mean, that paragraph is great. I wish Daryl Hart would read that paragraph. Because, you know, he's saying you can't be Reformed Baptist if you're John Piper. We agree. Yes. But what if you hold to the regular principle of worship? What if you hold to the abiding validity of the fourth commandment? What if you believe in covenant theology and you're not a dispensation? We agree, John MacArthur is not Reformed. But are you going to exclude people who are Reformed Baptists who hold to these things just because we also hold to credo baptism? So anyways, I thought Bingham's chapter was really, really excellent. I know some of you guys have read. I haven't read. What's the work he's written you guys have read?
His book, Orthodox Radicals, is a fleshing out sort of the history of particular Baptists, really within kind of the congregational movement in, you know, mid-1600s England.
So seeing them more as being influenced by the independents?
Yes, and the arguments that he makes in that book, which is a very readable, it's another expensive book because it's an academic book, but it's very readable. And the arguments that he makes are helpful because I think probably, just in my humble opinion, the two most significant books that have come out in the last 2 or 3 years on particular Baptist anything are this book, Orthodox Radicals, because he deals with this history question. And one of you brothers mentioned kind of this Reformed tree, and it's just an excellent summary of how not only were we not Anabaptists, we were clearly influenced by Reformed theology and the movement that was happening in England. And then the other book, I think, would be Sam Renahan's dissertation that came out a few years ago, just looking at the wealth of covenant theologies that were not monolithic, not uniform, and how our covenant theology, or the covenant theology that seems to be the most dominant in the Second London Confession of Faith, is another branch on that tree. You know, you brought up John Owen earlier. I think one of the challenges is, I mean, John Owen's covenant theology looks very familiar and very nice to me.
Yes.
And yet he was a Paedo Baptist. And so how do we balance all of these historical questions? Because in my opinion, R. Scott Clark sometimes goes after the history piece, and I think these two works, Bingham's in particular, really demonstrate there's a lot of primary source material that's there to say particular Baptists, the 1600s, were Reformed Baptists, right? Now, they didn't use that word, but they rightly would have been received by other Reformed individuals. I know, Steve, you read the book too, right?
And the other thing is, even then, even now, you continue to have Reformed Baptists that subscribe not only to a very closeness to John Owen's form of covenant theology, but also his church government, his polity.
Right.
So I just wonder, Clark, is he questioning John Owen and his position in the Reformed tree? You know, things such as that. But there does seem to be, with Hart, back to the book, there seems to be, with Hart, in the kindest way, a kind of ignorance about what Reformed Baptists that are confessional truly believe. Because I find myself interacting with Presbyterians typically, and I find myself much more Reformed than the average Presbyterian, in the sense that they hold to a view of the Lord's Supper that does not contend, that they do not believe in the spiritual presence of Christ in the Supper, that they deny the regulative principle of worship. And now we're being reminded by Crawford Gribben, you know, that their departure from the magistrate enforcing biblical, what's the language they would use? The biblical or confessional authority of the church, enforcing that in the land that they occupy. It goes back to what you were suggesting earlier, Ryan. At the end of the day, it's really only confessional Reformed Baptists who truly subscribe to a confession fully from the 16th century.
17th century.
So you have Presbyterians that have departed from, not all.
Well, you raise an interesting question. I mean, you know, so let's take somebody who's a member of a PCUSA church. Are they more Reformed than someone who's part of a confessional Reformed Baptist church? And sad to say, many PCA churches, you know, some of the ones that are now, you know, ordaining women deacons and having liturgical dancers in worship services. So they're Reformed. Those churches are Reformed by virtue of the fact that they adhere to some degree, at least on paper, the Westminster Confession of Faith, and that they practice infant baptism. But a solid, now I'm not talking about John Piper's church. A solid confessional Reformed Baptist church is guided by the regular principle and sings psalms, hymns and spiritual songs and does expositional preaching and fences the table and is conscientious in leadership and ministry. That loosey-goosey PCA church is Reformed, but the particular Baptist church or the Reformed Baptist church is not. Marvin, you
I think in the title of the chapter, I think He takes really the sword of the guys in the last two chapters when he admits that a Reformed Baptist is an anachronistic term.
Mm-hmm.
And we readily admit that for the same reasons we've been saying, is because there's no need for us to establish, and for non-Baptist people, they won't understand this, a trail of blood. But basically to establish our Reformed bona fides in terms of the Westminster Confession and all those. There's no need to, because again, there's the more dynamic sense of that in which we are after the spirit of the Reformation more so than, and our confession is, rather than binding us, is actually a tool in that regard. And again, you talked earlier about the common era in which the opposition to the Roman Catholic Church is one thing, is a great unifier. I sometimes wonder if that's not the origin of that particular article in the 1689, is the one we feel like we have to apologize today when it says the Pope is the Antichrist. That's something that we look at today, and I don't know that we're embarrassed by it, but it's something that everybody said, do I have to believe that? But But again, I think going back to this anachronism, going back to the spirit of the age in which it was created, it is a profound statement in the fact that it goes all the way back against Rome and any vestige of Rome to affirm the five solas. And that is where our strength is. And so we proudly say Reformed Baptist is an anachronism and say that that's the strength of it.
Hmm. But I think, backing up a little bit, we can agree with Clark and Hart that we don't want to say that the term Reformed has become so elastic that it has no meaning at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think they are probably responding to the Young Restless Reform Movement, the things that took place in the 90s and beginning in the 2000s with, you know, from John Piper and those kind of things that transpired. And they're trying to guard that and protect their brand.
Yeah.
But we're in agreement. We do not think it should be every...
Well, I'm just as equally frustrated sometimes I'll have somebody who's discovered Calvinism.
Yeah.
And they'll come to my church, but then they'll say, well, you know, I'm going to start attending this Calvinistic Southern Baptist church down the road that doesn't hold to the 1689 confession. And they're like, well, you know, they're Calvinistic too. They're Reformed too. And I have to restrain myself because I want to grab them and, you know, shake their shoulders and say, they're not Reformed. You know, they don't hold the confessional Reformed theology.
Right.
But it doesn't do any good because that person doesn't really have enough information and knowledge to understand what that difference is. Now, they might be able to be taught, and certainly if they would come into churches like ours and experience it over a period of time, they would imbibe what that difference is. And I think it would make a big difference in their lives. But sometimes you can't convince people of that. But yeah, we're just as frustrated by people who use the Reformed label who aren't really fully confessionally Reformed. And we believe it's more than the 5 points of Calvinism.
Yeah.
And it's unfair, I think. And that's one of the places where I had to walk away from the chapter when I read it, is to try to tie that around our neck. I mean, it's just unfair to do that. Because if you say we're as frustrated by that as they are.
Yeah.
And with Clark, not only do we not want the term to not have any true meaning, on the same side, we want to press against those dear brothers of the Presbyterian persuasion that write in that book to acknowledge the reality that the Reformation was by far more diverse than they're willing to acknowledge.
Yes.
Whether it's covenant theology, whether it's church polity, there was much more diversity than they're willing to admit in those, at least in those writings. But I think sitting out with a cup of coffee and being pressed, they would have to acknowledge that.
Mm. Let me just briefly touch on the two last articles. So the third article, as I've already mentioned, is the one by Daryl Hart, who teaches in the history department at Hillsdale College in Michigan, and is very well known as a historian in OPC circles. And his chapter is called "Baptists Are Different." The first line is, "Baptists suffer from an inferiority complex." He's funny. I like him as a writer. He's hilarious. But he, you know, all through the thing, he refers to Reformed Baptists as predestinarian Baptists. You know, and again, as we talked about before, you know, he doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that there are confessional Reformed Baptist churches. He wants to lump us in with John Piper's and so forth. There's a section where he talks about, this is page 64, about pan-denominational efforts like Banner of Truth, ACE or TGC, Together for the Gospel, I guess that is, or the Gospel Coalition, need a Calvinism that includes Baptists, especially after the resurgence of predestinarian theology in the Southern Baptist Convention. So again, he's only addressing sort of Young Restless Reform and doesn't really seem to be aware of the difference. He has a part in here I want to call attention to. It's a quote from Sean Wright, who teaches church history at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, And I remember this. He did an article on the Nine Marks website, why your church should not use the 1689 Confession. And but he's citing Sean Wright, like he's a representative of those who call themselves Reformed Baptists. I despise that article that Sean Wright wrote. It's ridiculous. You should adopt the 1689 Confession if you want to be robustly reformed, if you want to sort of be in the, you know, in the hinterland or middle land and just be Calvinistic in soteriology and not take it to its further ends. But anyway, so I was like you, I didn't walk away from it, but I was frustrated when I was reading Hart. And I love him as a writer, and I appreciate a lot of things he's written about worship and other things. Sorry.
No, it's comical to hear, as you read that quote, the lumping together of Banner of Truth and TGC sort of in the same kind of...
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. You've got Axe to Grinding as Banner of Truth, too?
Those are very broad, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because Daryl Hart uses these terms, lumpers and splitters.
Yes.
Lumpers, he says, is what the first two articles are trying to do, is they're trying to lump us together with the good parts of every other Reformed community, every other Reformed confession. And the splitters, it says, is what they do. In other words, they're the historians. They're the ones that have the fine view on the distinction, the differences, and think that that's what adds vitality to the study. When indeed, I mean, as Ryan just said, there's huge lumping on their part. What they accuse us of, it's projection, basically, because they are, I think, in many cases, guilty of just lumping us together, not in a favorable way, but in an unfavorable way, with some of the excesses that we don't care for either.
Ben, you've been quiet for a while. Anything to add on this?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the whole issue, if you just look at it historically, I think it was very clear that our forebears saw themselves in that tradition. So, you know, coming up to a modern-day argument of, well, are we Reformed Baptists or not, again, we're going back to what our forebears held to. And again, there were disagreements back there. I mean, he's got a couple of sources he cited where there were people coming out, you know, against Reformed Baptists saying, okay, they've written their confession, but really they're Anabaptists. They're hiding behind their confession, and they're not being truthful with you. And so he's got a couple of sources going all the way back to the 1600s citing that. I like the one he cited. I forgot who the author was, but The Dipper's Dipped.
Yeah.
Catchy title there.
Right.
But again, you know, and you might have some of those way back in that age who were saying, no, you're not Reformed. But as far as our forebears, as they sat down to draft the Second London Baptist Confession, and as the theology of that confession was already in place, because the confession is drafted, off of the theology that's already being followed, they saw themselves clearly in that stream. I mean, we're copying almost all of the Westminster Confession of Faith.
Yeah.
How can we not see ourselves in the stream of Reformed theology? And therefore, in that sense, call ourselves, you know, Reformed. Although, again, you know, that they wouldn't see that. I mean, they were called particular Baptists because it all centered on the doctrine of the atonement, you know. Mm-hmm. But, again, they're clearly in that stream. So, again, if some of their day did not want to recognize that, and again, the two sources he cites for why they didn't recognize that were saying they were attributing motives to them. They're saying, no, they're really Anabaptists, but they're hiding their Anabaptism. Now, assuming that they're wrong, and they were, if they're not Anabaptists and they're not hiding Anabaptism, Anabaptist tendencies, would they then have fit in the Reformed tradition in these men's eyes way back in the 1600s?
Hmm.
Because, again, the reason they gave is you're not being truthful with your confessional statement.
Hmm.
Well, and I think this is where doctrinal investigation is so helpful. Is the fact that in the Anabaptists, and I surely as historians, they've studied this material, understand that a primary distinction between them and the Baptists in general, in particular the particular Baptists, is their anthropology, their doctrine of sin. most of the Anabaptists, and I took a PhD seminar at Southwestern on the Radical Reformation. And one thing you see outside of the excesses and great, not just error, but heresy that the Anabaptists fall into, one thing they all have in common is they never abandon a Roman Catholic view of sin.
Mm.
And as such, yeah. Then they're bound to commit the kind of errors that they do. And rather than to trace that out, and rather than to say, okay, this is where that goes, rather than to try to lump us into that, it really is trying to. It's a distinction that really needs to be made, and it points to the fact that when we do that, that we really are the heirs of the Reformation, that we really are, although we don't condone their methods, we really are on the side of Calvin and Luther and the continental reformers in their opposition to the Anabaptists because of the excesses and because they never abandoned Rome.
Yeah, so it would be historically an error to lump particular Baptists on anthropology.
It's a bad lump. You know,
we've got to split. Yeah. We've got to split them off and put them in the camp with the classical Reformed theology. Let me just briefly, where we're getting close to nearly an hour, I want to give at least some mention of the fourth chapter. So let me just mention a couple things about it, and we can bring the conversation to a close. So the last chapter is by R. Scott Clark, appropriately enough, you know, the person who, you know, brought the conversation about it. We're happy. I really appreciate a lot of his stimulating work. His work is very stimulating, I think, and encouraging, even if it challenges, makes us think through things. But it's titled A House of Cards, A Response to Bingham, Gribbin, and Coffee. And one interesting thing he says in there, just another little historical anecdote, on page 72, he says the earliest reference to Reformed Baptists dates to 1826. Just a little interesting tidbit. He says it is certainly not a 17th century expression. Indeed, it seems to have become widely used expression only after World War II. One of the things that he says is that he puts a lot of the distinction on covenant theology. So this is on page 80. He says, at essential points, the particular Baptists confess a different reading of redemptive history, one that has more in common with the Anabaptists than it does with the Reformed. And this is another area where it doesn't seem that he is in touch with what Bingham talked about, and that is the fact that there were particular Baptists who had a federal view of covenant theology, and how that's actually being revived to some degree in our day by contemporary writers like you mentioned, Sam Renahan, and what's the Canadian fellow?
Pascal Deneau.
Pascal Deneau and others. So at the very end, let me just read his last statement, and we'll just have some final comments so that I don't want us to give him a short shrift. But the last paragraph, he says, this is R. Scott Clark, by my light, the Reformed house stands in need of repair, but she still has foundations, walls, and her confessing inhabitants are still living in and working around the old home place. So far, she has survived attempted ecclesiocides, if you will, in the 1560s and 1570s in the Netherlands and France, the Enlightenment and Modernism in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, and Deo Volente, God willing, she will survive late modern deconstructionism. For those of us who still live in her, she is not a house of cards, but a house built on a divine promise. And he closes with quoting Acts 2:39, in your face, Baptist. For the promise is to you and to your children and to all those who are distant, as many as the Lord our God will call. Of course, we would focus on that last statement there. As many as our Lord will call. So that passage can't be used as a silver bullet against Baptists because we exegete it.
And we would focus on and to all those who are distant.
Who are distant.
Not just the children.
Yes, not just the covenant family, right. But those who are outside of the faith. Right. So, anybody with any closing comments on this?
Just one thought, and it's not so much to R. Scott Clark's chapter, although the main point there, it's more towards that in the covenant theology. I find it ironic that the debate is, you know, Reformed, Confessional Reformed Baptists shouldn't use the term Reformed because they have a different view of the covenant. And, of course, we've already talked about this. But I would almost want to turn that back and ask the question, well, within Presbyterianism or three forms of unity churches today, and even in academic institutions, to potentially include the one that our brother teaches at, there are differences of the covenant, whether that's the republication debate or mm-hmm. others. And so how to say that we as Confessional Reformed Baptists, because we have a slightly different view of the covenant of grace, you know, essentially we could say we might do with the Abrahamic covenant what they were willing to do, some of them with the Mosaic covenant. But that aside, the irony to me is if we're going to make this case on a historical basis, I just think the modern research that really digs the primary sources is solid in Bingham's work and others. But if we're going to make the case based on differences of covenant theology, is it possible that within this house there are some cards that are still not settled within the Paedo-Baptist side, because they too have had differences, grave differences, in their own understanding of the covenant of grace? Mm-hmm. So it's just ironic to me.
Well, and this raises the problem of being a policeman, you know, and enforcing, you know, who's in, who's out in this matter. Well, guys, thank you so much for your participation. I appreciate it. Steve, one last thing.
I was just going to say in closing, James T. Denison includes the 1644 and the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1677 in his fourth volume of Reformed Confessions of the 16th and 17th centuries. And I think it needs to stay there.
Yeah, let's hope it stays there. Man?
I've just got one more thing, and it's a question for you. Practically, what does this mean? How does this affect you, whether certain people of a Reformed Presbyterian stripe can say whether or not you can use that label as you would use it wherever you would use it?
Well, I mean, it doesn't, you know, I don't think it means I'll change anything about what I'm practicing. I mean, I have thought about it. I mean, it has made me think, this conversation, even after I think I read his book 10 years ago. And that is, I don't want to overstep my boundaries. I respect, you know, I respect, let's say, the OPC. I respect them as a denomination, that they will not allow somebody who has Baptistic convictions to join because they're not going to be willing to baptize their children. I really appreciate that. In fact, I appreciate that a lot better than I do, say, the PCA church that allows people who are really Baptist to join their church. So I have respect for the fact that they have those convictions, and I admire them for having that. And I don't want to take the label of being Reformed in such a way that would be offensive to them. But on the other hand, I would say that with Bingham, that I think it is anachronistic to call the earlier particular Baptist Reformed Baptist, but I don't think it's oxymoronic to call my church a Reformed Baptist church, because we do hold to the sovereignty of God in salvation and Calvinistic soteriology and the regulative principle and the abiding validity of the moral law, and our ecclesiology is not loosey-goosey anything goes congregationalism. It's elder-led. And so I don't think it's inappropriate, but I appreciate being pressed to think about it, and maybe it will help me as a pastor to articulate that to my church so that they have a better understanding of who we are, what we stand for, what our convictions are, and it'll help me to interpret that to people maybe who are visiting our church who want to know, who are you guys and what does this term Reformed mean? So I see some benefits in thinking about it. And, you know, for somebody who, you know, maybe who's on the more intellectual side, I wish this thing weren't so expensive, because I think it's a good, you know, set of essays. And one of the things I'm really proud of is, man, we've got some Reformed Baptists who have some intellectual firepower.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And those two essays by Coffey and Gribben and by Bingham are excellent. And so it's nice to see people from our confessional background who are able, in a charitable and very intellectually formidable way, to put forward strong arguments for our position. So I appreciate that. Anybody else have a last statement?
I would just say that I think for me, it reminds me that we can have a very Reformed and Catholic spirit with other Reformed brethren.
Yes.
And, you know, parachurch is another discussion. But we see examples of this, like in Ligonier Ministries, that Baptistic Pado Baptist brothers, on some level, can walk together, do certain forms of ministry, in this sense, like a conference or something together, and even aspects on a local church, and that's another discussion. But when we look at the broader Christendom, there seems to be, within Reformed circles, so much that unites us that we should be able to walk together on some level of a common Reformed Catholicity.
Yeah. Yeah. Brothers, thank you so much. Hope this episode has been helpful to those who are listening. I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of Word Magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.